Hello and welcome to the Island Library Podcast. I'm Laura from Laura Liz Buckley.
And I'm Jo from Pages of the Moon.
And welcome to episode 11.
Whoop woo!
This week we didn't have a theme as such, but I think we both went for reads that we were expecting to have a bit of fun with. What did you read this week, Jo?
I read Malibu Rising by Taylor Jenkins Reid.
I've heard so much about that, so I'm really excited to hear you talk about it.
I'm so excited to tell you all about it.
I read All Our Hidden Gifts by Caroline O'Donoghue,
which is a book I have read.
Woohoo! So, as usual, the way it's going to work is first Jo and I will read the blurbs of our books, then I'm going to pitch All Our Hidden Gifts to try and persuade Jo to read it, even though she already has. Then I'm going to talk through what I thought about it, likes, dislikes, of course, seashell rating, and the all-important question. And then it's Jo's turn to do the same for her book. And we will finish off with a random question of the week. So, I'll kick us off with the blurb of All Our Hidden Gifts. Maeve Chambers doesn't have any special gifts. That is until she finds a dusty old pack of tarot cards and starts giving uncannily accurate readings to everyone around her. But when she reads for her ex-best friend Lily, a strange card appears in the deck and everything goes wrong. Lily doesn't come to school the next day, or the next, and Maeve knows she's been taken somewhere the police will never find her. Only the cards, and something older, something even more powerful, can bring her back.
Ooh.
Yep. Sinister.
Dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a different turn, here is the blurb for Malibu Rising. It's quite a long blurb, so I have trimmed it, but it is still quite long, but it's sort of needed. I couldn't really cut any more out. Malibu, August 1983. It's the day of Nina Rivers' annual end of summer party, and anticipation is at a fever pitch. Everyone wants to be around the famous Rivers. Nina, the talented surfer and supermodel, brothers Jay and Hood, one a championship surfer, the other a renowned photographer, and their adorned baby sister Kit. Together, the siblings are a source of fascination in Malibu and the world over, especially as the offspring of the legendary singer Mick River. The only person not looking forward to the party of the year is Nina herself, who never wants to be the centre of attention and who has also just been very publicly abandoned by her pro tennis player husband. By midnight, the party will be completely out of control. By morning, the River Mansion will have gone up in flames, but before that first spark in the early hours before dawn, the alcohol will flow, the music will play, and the loves and secrets that shape this family's generations will all come bubbling to the surface.
Well.
I might be saying the surname wrong. I've heard some people say River, but I'm going with River for it just because that's how I was reading it. Normally I would go back and I would check, but there's that many different ways it's being said. I've just gone with the easiest one for my brain to pronunciate. Because okay. We all know I have pronunciation issues.
Fair enough. Okay, so that sounds like a lot going on.
I feel like we've both got very dramatic books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before we get started, mine is a YA. I'm imagining yours is not.
Yes, mine is adult, contemporary. Okay. I wouldn't say it's like romance, so to speak, but I'll get more into that
sure.
As we delve into the book.
No problem. Okay, so I'm going to pitch All Our Hidden Gifts.
Ooh.
Maeve is a bit of a lone wolf, particularly since cutting her ex-best friend Lily loose to pursue a more popular crowd, not entirely successfully. When she finds a mysterious deck of tarot cards during a detention, though, Maeve steps into a whole new social world. Everybody wants a reading, and weirder still, Maeve seems to be a natural at interpreting the cards. But magic can have a dark side, and Maeve's dabbling in witchcraft she doesn't fully understand may have released something sinister and dangerous. When Lily goes missing and hatred gets stirred up in their town, Maeve knows she has to find a way to set things right, whatever it takes.
I think that would persuade me to read the book. I think you have successfully accomplished your mission.
I wanted to draw out more one of the other big threads of this book, which I will come onto in more detail. But obviously the blurb really only talks about Lily as the kind of main storyline. But the book loses focus of Lily a couple of times, which I don't think is necessarily the end of the world. I can see how it could be frustrating, but it's covering a bit more than just Lily. But we will come to that. So, I found Maeve pretty endearing. she has a tendency to kind of lash out and say things that upset people, and then she feels bad about it but doesn't know how to apologize. So, you know, I kind of like that in a main character. Her family is full of really smart people. Like, she talks about having a family of geniuses, and she's not good at school. She doesn't remember stuff easily. She's not a natural. And when the tarot comes so easily to her, it's kind of the first thing that she's felt naturally talented at, which is quite sweet. She's very headstrong, occasionally behaves quite rashly, which is not unusual for a teenager, but it makes her a really active force in the plot, which I think is important in a main character and helps to feel like she is really driving the story forwards, even when it gets a little off track at times. That's kind of a function of her getting distracted and focusing on other stuff. So I thought that all felt really natural, and there wasn't any point where I was reading it and I thought, why are we spending so long on this? Except for one thing, which I'll come to. But by and large, the detours that the plot took, I thought made a lot of sense. And then, so the story actually starts with her getting put in detention for throwing a shoe at a teacher, which, you know, strong move.
Loved.
As an ex-teacher, I cannot condone shoe throwing in the classroom.
And there's me going, love that, love that.
I mean, it's fine. Nobody ever threw a shoe at me, so good. I'm not personally triggered.
Okay.
There's a really nice cast of secondary characters in this book. I like Maeve's parents. They're not much of a presence, particularly because I think they go away for a little bit and leave Maeve's older sister kind of supervising, but they're nice. I like a YA where the protagonist doesn't arbitrarily hate their parents and vice versa. They're not super close. That's not like a function of the story, but they just have a pretty pleasant working relationship as parent and daughter, which I appreciate. She's got older siblings, some of whom are more important than others. The one that we mostly see is Joanne, who is a lesbian who has just broken up with her ex-girlfriend for cheating on her, but they get back together quite soon, and their relationship has quite a lot of page time in the story, and was really nice to see that kind of play out. Obviously, we don't get a lot of insight into how they are with each other because the story is entirely told from Maeve's point of view, but having that relationship front and center in the story is nice. There is obviously her ex-best friend Lily, who disappears quite early, but Lily has a brother who becomes kind of a love interest to Maeve. Now, he is non-binary, gender fluid. He goes by he, him pronouns throughout the novel, so that's what I'm going to use for him. But he is exploring his gender presentation and his identity. And I thought that was handled really well from my understanding of it. He's still definitely at a very explorative phase and doesn't fully know how he wants to present himself full time. Maeve has moments where she doesn't quite get it, but she is really supportive and wants to understand, which I thought was sweet. And he gives her the name Ro to use, so that's what she uses for him from then moving forwards. But she's also sensitive about not wanting to give other people more information than they need about him, so which I thought was also nicely handled. So, you know, she does introduce, she talks about him as Ro to kind of friends, and then there's a moment where she kind of forgets, not forgets, there's a moment where someone else kind of uses his old name, the name that they're used to calling him, and she's kind of like, oh yeah, no, I forgot that's that other people that's don't necessarily know that he's called Ro. Weird. A lot of the book, as you might have gathered from this, does focus on LGBTQ plus experiences and allyship. Obviously, Maeve is straight and cisgendered, so the protagonist doesn't have a marginalized identity, but there is a lot of focus on how she wants to support and her trying to learn more and how to be a good ally to the people that she loves who do have these marginalized gender and sexual identities. There's also some exploration of issues around race, although that gets less of a focus, but mostly through another fantastic character, Fiona, who is Filipino and kind of becomes the best friend figure. She loves acting and drama. She's a real kind of force of nature. Her family has, she's got this aunt, her Tita, who is kind of witchy and very into witchcraft, the occult. And it was nice to have that window into a non-white representation of magic, because obviously most of the book, most of the characters who you see engaging in witchy stuff are white, but there's a real emphasis on the fact that witchcraft and magic do not belong to white people. Like, this is something that's practiced and acknowledged throughout the world across loads of different cultures in different ways and in overlapping ways. So I appreciated that. There's one really nice moment towards the end where Maeve realises that she's not kind of fully appreciated how difficult it is for Fiona on a day-to-day basis being Filipino in what sounds like a not particularly diverse, racially diverse community. But definitely the race side of things is not focused on as much as the LGBTQ plus side. It's kind of, I wouldn't say it's sidelined as such, but it definitely doesn't have as much of a focus. I picked up the book initially for the tarot vibes because I recently bought like this gorgeous set of tarot cards. So Joe and I were actually, this is when we got together and we spent some time roaming a bookshop in person, which was lovely. And this book caught my eye partly because I was like, oh, that looks sort of tarot-y. I'm in a tarot-y kind of mood. So I really enjoyed the tarot readings. You get more of them at the beginning and they feature less as you progress through the book, although the author does still keep that thread going and Maeve does continue to use the tarot to get in touch with kind of that side of her and her awakening abilities and to try and find answers about what's happened to Lily. There is a sinister edge that comes in every so often, even right at the start. So quite early on, she's looking through this deck and she finds there's this rogue card, the housekeeper, which shows a woman with long dark hair in a white dress holding a knife between her teeth. So it's a sinister card and it's not one that exists in the tarot. She represents a separate magical, mystical figure. So again, in the first few chapters, Lily gets kind of cornered into accepting a tarot reading from Maeve, who's also very reluctant to do it. And the first two cards are kind of quite difficult, sad cards. And then she draws the housekeeper. And Lily is like, what does that mean? And Maeve's like, I don't know. And then Lily's pissed off. And then Maeve's pissed off that Lily's pissed off. And then Maeve wishes that Lily would just disappear. And lo, Lily disappears. And she is not seen again. So obviously Maeve is like, oh God, this is my fault. I've summoned something weird with the housekeeper and I've vanished my ex-bestie. I have to get her back. And this is the initial driving force of the plot. Although this is why I wanted to pull in the kind of hatred getting stirred up element in my pitch, because the blurb makes it sound like the driving force is getting Lily back for the whole story. But there's this whole substantial side plot around this guy and his group of kind of religious fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, who are acting out against people with different gender and sexual identities. And they are harassing people. They are showing up in queer friendly spaces to make trouble. And Maeve feels like these things are connected, that the increase in these aggressive acts and this hostility is tied to the unleashing of the housekeeper. There's also something a bit odd about the guy who's in charge. He seems to have an uncanny power over people. So there is an implication from early on that there's more to him than just your bog standard bigot. The story spends quite a lot of time exploring that. And Lily's plight takes a little bit of a backseat. I wouldn't say it gets forgotten entirely, and it didn't bother me in the slightest. It felt like a really natural development of Maeve's interest in what was going on, that she would get drawn into this stuff, particularly because she's falling for Ro, who is kind of just trying to find his feet in the community and work out who he is and how he wants to be perceived. And so she is taking it particularly to heart that his safety is being threatened. And also her sister, who she loves, even if she doesn't always get on with, is, you know, experiencing an increase in harassment for just being out with her girlfriend. So she's got these really strong ties to that community and really wants to try and help protect them if she can. So I think it's arguable that the pace of the main storyline struggled a little at some points, but I think it was balanced out with fun character moments and interesting developments in other areas of the plot and sort of side plots and plot threads that were being developed. So it didn't bother me. The only thing that I did feel less interested in was the kind of historical aspect. So she goes down a bit of a rabbit hole of looking into the last time the housekeeper potentially was summoned and why that happened and who did it and what the consequences were. I didn't hate it, but it didn't interest me as much as the stuff that was going on in the present. And given that there was quite a lot going on in the present, I don't know if it really served the book to have that detour. I could see the point of it when it was happening. It wasn't like I was totally tuned out and skimming and looking for the real story to start again. I just don't think it was massively necessary and certainly not the most engaging bit. There wasn't a lot that surprised me in the story. I wouldn't quite say it's like massively predictable, but it falls within pretty standard YA contemporary slash fantasy parameters, which I was totally fine with. The inclusion of more diverse representation felt like it brought something fresh to the story. And so the plot itself playing out along some fairly familiar lines was totally okay with me. It was a really engaging read. I sort of started it. I read the first couple of pages one evening and then set it down. And then I opened it up the next day intending to like read a little bit before work. And then I spent the rest of the day looking for scraps of time where I could get back to it in between tasks because I just wanted to know what was going to happen next. So, you know, it's definitely a read that draws you in. I thought the ending was a nice combination of tying things up and setting up new threads because it is the first of an indeterminate length series. I know there's a book two planned. I don't know if it's meant to be a duology, a trilogy, a longer series. It feels like it could have some staying power as a series. I don't want to give away anything about the way various characters are left at the end, but it definitely feels like it's being set up as something that could run and have characters developing further and learning more and taking on different kinds of antagonists and sort of threats in their realm.
No, I agree. When I read the book, I didn't know there was a sequel until I was writing up my review for it. And I was like, oh, there's going to be another book. That's really, really exciting. So I completely agree with you. I was like, oh, there's more to deal with here, but I do like the ending. So, okay. And then I found out it was another book and I was like, okay, this makes more sense.
Yes. No, for sure. It was interesting. It didn't leave me feeling frustrated that I couldn't immediately go out and read book two. It felt like, you know, it left the characters in a place where if something happened and the author never got around to book two, because, you know, she started on other projects and whatever, I wouldn't feel like, oh, well, I've been cheated. I wish I'd never read this. Where there are definitely some book ones where you think, if I don't get a book two for this, then what was the point?
Yeah. Yeah. We've read some, I think we've read some.
I feel like we've had some of those comments. Yeah, I feel like there have been some of those. But I will be excited when book two comes out and I can rejoin these characters and see what they're up to. I mean, I'm kind of in wrap-up mode now. I don't know if there was anything that you wanted to jump in and ask about.
I think everything that I thought, you've sort of hit on the head sort of thing. I think I would have been quite happy to have the book a little bit longer and explore that group a little bit more, just because I feel like more towards the end, it was trying to wrap it up.
Yeah.
I think that was my only thing. And I was just to see whether you agree with that. But since you've just said, yeah, I'm guessing that you did. I think because they had such a nice build into the story that when it came to near the ending, it was like, oh God, we need to put this in a nice place. And I do agree, because like when I was reading it, I didn't know there was going to be a book two. I think that was my only big critique of the book.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there are elements of the ending that felt not as well paced out as some of the other stuff. It felt like something's got a little bit rushed there. Again, I mean, I don't think it was disastrous, but I know what you mean. It was definitely noticeable.
Yeah, it didn't take away my enjoyment either. It was just, you know, when you look at like, okay, what would I have wanted differently? I think that would have been the only thing.
Yeah, no, yeah. For sure. So in terms of kind of wrap up, I'd say All Our Hidden Gifts is really fun. It's got solid writing and storytelling. While it's not enormously surprising, it definitely kept me engaged. I felt like it did some intelligent and interesting things within the framework of a pretty standard story. So elements of interactions between characters felt like they had more nuance and a little bit more subtlety than you might typically get from a YA book. The way that the different types of representation were handled, I thought, were done with sensitivity and attention to detail, which elevated the story, even though if you just take the story beats, it doesn't necessarily look like anything that special. I think it was something a bit special. In terms of seashell rating, I struggled with this. When I first finished it, I was like, that is a 5-shell read, hands down. Then I went away and wrote up my thoughts and kind of got some space from it. And I was like, yeah, maybe it's more like 4. Like, I really enjoyed it, but I don't know if I loved it. And now talking about it, I'm really stumped between the two. I think I'm going to have to go 4.5, even though I'm trying to move away from half shells. But it really is teetering on the fence between I loved it and I really liked it.
Yeah. So, would you take this book to your island library?
Oh, it's a tough one. For the moment, I'm going to say no.
Ooh.
Because as much as I enjoyed it, and as much as I will read it again, I don't think it kicks off the books that are already there. But when book 2 comes out, depending on how that develops certain things and the way that the characters were left, how that continues to play out, that might push it over into the series or the series so far being a yes. So I think I'm going to revisit it when we get book 2. Because if the author can sustain what she started and build on it to make something even stronger, then it will be a no-brainer, I think.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. No, that makes a lot of sense. Wonderful.
Okay.
Okay.
Right, let's be hearing it. Malibu Rising.
Malibu Rising. I'm going to ramble. I'm just throwing it out there. But I'm going to start off with the good old pitch. I really struggled with my pitch this week because Taylor Jenkins Reid just does something to me with her words. And aww. I just feel like when she writes a blurb for a book, it gets the book completely. It's like there's not many things that she leaves out.
Okay.
So I've trimmed mine down quite a lot compared to hers. But Nina never wanted to be famous. It never even crossed her mind. But then not a lot has had the chance to pass her mind when she has always looked after her siblings. That's all she's ever done, going back as far as looking after her mum when her dad had left. She throws the party for everyone else, but in 1983, everything changes. While the mansion will burn to the ground by the morning, it isn't the only thing which will be forever changed, as secrets, dreams and futures are laid out amongst the music, drugs and alcohol.
Mm.
I stripped mine back quite a lot. It was quite hard to sort of top the blurb that's out there, because the blurb that is out there is I've trimmed it down, and even as I was saying it to you, I was like, this is a long blurb. Now, the book is told from two points of sort of view. It's a number of characters, but it's sort of two different time periods mm-hmm. that are being told. So the first one is the present Reva family. So it's a lot of Nina, but we do get into some of the other siblings' heads, which I'll just recap, are Jay and Hood and Kit. So there's 4 of them. There's an odd family dynamic going off, which I'll explore a little bit later. But Nina is firstborn. She was the one with the most memories of her dad. Kit is the youngest with 0 memories. And this sort of, I would say, like, ghostly figure in her mind of what her dad could have been or what he was like. And the mm-hmm. 2 boys are just 2 boys, basically. I mean, they're all in, like, they're like, I think they're in their mid-20s. They range, obviously, I think Nina's the oldest. I don't think she's 30 yet, but I could be wrong. But yeah, they're all in their 20s. They're all adults, basically. The second time period is from the 50s. So we find out how the mum and dad met, which is Mick and June. So Mick meets June, and June's all brown eyes, all big. It's the 50s. She's all coy, you know, don't touch me until we get married. Mick's the playboy. His parents have passed away very recently. He has moved to Malibu. He promises her the world. He gives her a sort of a cheap ring and promises her when he makes it big, he'll give her a diamond that, you know, blinds everybody. And she's just swept up in it. Her parents are obviously a little bit, you know, on the fence about Mick. Her dad especially makes him promise that if he hasn't made it big by a couple of years, he'll come back and he'll take over their family restaurant, which is something that June does not want at all. June does not want to work in this restaurant. She wants to be looked after. She wants to be in a loving marriage, being looked after by, you know, this wannabe celebrity and have lots of babies. Like, she wants to live the dream. And so a lot of the time, I think she's very blind to what Mick is really like, which is unfortunate. And we get a proper play-by-play of that over time. We sort of, because of the way the story is told, you know things before sometimes we'd sort of told them, because, you know, with us being in the present, we know that the dad was never around. We know he never came back. And obviously, I think it was at a certain point in the book, Nina, Jay and Hood were all born, but June and Mick had divorced. So it was like, well, where's Kit going to come from? And then obviously I was like, oh God, they're going to go back together again and have Kit, and then he's going to leave again. And lo and behold, that's what he did.
Aww.
It's not the most surprising, I would say, in the terms of, as soon as Mick meets June, you know that he's gone for the easy girl that will stay at home and look after all of this while he can be on the road. You know that. Like, he is doting at first, don't get me wrong, but there are instances, like early red flags, where you think, okay, you're just going to be a proper dick. And lo and behold, he was a dick. So none of his arc is that surprising. I would find that at times I didn't realise he would go as low as he did, but it's not an overall surprising development. The most surprising thing, I think, was June. I'm not going to go super into what happens with June, but she does pass away when the children are quite young, just before Nina can officially be an adult. Thankfully, the town sort of protect them, and so they like turn their eyes away a little bit before Nina turns 16, before she can actually, you know, adopt her siblings, because the town, I know that they've been through a lot. Like, everyone knows June is Mick's ex-wife. Mick's now this massive celebrity, and I mean, he is huge of the time. I don't know all that much about Mick, but I know that he's been mentioned in some of Taylor's other work. So
okay.
If you're fans of The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, some of the characters from that book crop up in mere mention. And I know that he's further explored in Daisy Jones and the Six as well, which is a book I need to get around to. There are a couple of things I just want to say before I get into the nitty and gritty of the story. Just some slight trigger warnings for this book. It is an adult's book, so it does deal with a lot of adult themes, but there is alcohol abuse, drugs, infidelity. There's also, there's a death in the book, a close family member, which is June, and her daughter, Nina, stumbles over her death, which can be quite triggering, I think, for some people. I think with the world that Taylor Jenkins Reid builds, you know, it's this glamorous sort of alcohol, drug-infused world. So these things probably aren't that unpredictable. And I didn't actually find it all that jarring myself, because I know the world that which she builds often. It's very scandalous. It's very, sure. You know, it's the dark side of fame. So I wasn't wholeheartedly surprised, but it did hurt. It was quite an emotional read, actually. Which is funny because her surname's Reed. Didn't mean to do a pun. When it comes to the party, the book is told in two parts. So halfway through the book, it swaps, and then we get the evening of the party. So we get like 7 a.m. until 7 p.m. And then in the second part of the book, we get 7 p.m. until 7 a.m. In all of that, we flash back to the 50s, then we come back to the present, which is 1983. The party is, as you can probably guess, attended by literally everybody. The only comparison I could probably make is for our time is like P. Diddy's white party, you know, where everyone dresses white and they go to his party. It's literally everybody. And that's where you get the sort of mentions of, you know, from Taylor's other books, you sort of get in passing the other names, which I thought was really nice. And I was like, I'm sure that's such and such from such book. And I quickly grabbed my phone. I was like, it is. That's so exciting. My favorite thing, though, aside from all of this, is just how we delve into these four siblings. It takes us a while to get really why Nina is sort of become the head of the family. We don't really learn that until halfway through the book. But it was so painful. The amount that she's had to sacrifice was just so beautifully written. And I know some people because I've gone back and I've read some of the reviews since this. Some people, I think, have this issue with the disconnect that Taylor sort of creates when she writes characters. But I don't think she's holding at arm's length, so to speak. I think it's more that she creates a space for you to either connect or disconnect from a certain character. And if you can relate to them, or if you've ever felt that same anguish, it makes it so much more powerful. I think it's that she doesn't tell you how you should feel. It's like, this is the fact. This is how sort of half of how Nina feels. She's holding the rest back for you. And if you can relate, then you fill that gap and it's just so powerful. I think I've said that when I discussed one of her previous books on the podcast. There's just something about her writing that just pulls me in. And I find that when I've finished the book, I'm drained, but in a good way. It's in a way that sort of feels like you've just been through a massive ordeal with somebody and you need a couple of tissues. That's how I feel whenever I read her work. And this book is no different. To that. Because of the flashbacks, we can obviously see how toxic June and Mick are, as much as, you know, June was swept up initially, and, you know, he calls her Junie and he says that he loves her. He cheats. She's at home with the kids. And there's this scene and it sort of sets the tone for me of how the whole family dynamic begins. But she's trying to make dinner. She's trying to make Mick happy. So Nina is like plunked in front of the TV and she's got Jay on her hip and she's trying to sort out the food. And there's a knock on the door and she's like, oh, you know, and she goes to the door and this woman is like, I can't do this. And just hands June this baby and says, it's Mick's son. I can't do this. I'm really sorry. And she just leaves and she just gives this baby to June and she's just there like,
Oh my God. She goes
through such a wave of emotion. She's like, oh my God, because the baby won't stop crying. She's like, okay, I've got another baby. Like, what the hell? And then she's also like, my husband cheated on me. And it's like the first time that she's been suspicious.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he doesn't like call her all that often. You know, he's away a lot of the time. She's suspicious, but this isn't just you finding out that your husband cheated on you. This is your husband's cheated on you and he's had another child with somebody else.
Yeah.
And that child ends up being Hood. So she makes the commitment to that this baby needs a mom and she'll be the mom. And she tries to lock the door. She tries to get a locksmith to come round to lock Mick out before he gets home for dinner. But the locksmith won't lock the door because we're in the 50s. And because she doesn't own the house, Mick does. They own it together. And, you know, he's the man of the house.
Aww.
So she's like, okay, well, I'm stuck. I don't know what to do. She then lodges the door handle with the dining room chair. And he comes home and he's like calling through the door and he's like saying how much he's sorry. And she's just like, it's taking me literally like 2 hours to get the kids down to sleep. Especially like this new baby that I know nothing of can just come in and just shut up. I don't really know how she had the strength to do it, but she was like, I'm gonna be his mum, you're his dad, we'll raise them as twins. And so Jay and Hood grow up as twins. They do find out eventually that they're not twins. There's a scene later on where Hood is a little bit unsure about, you know, whether to go find his mum or not, but that thread sort of gets dropped because there's a lot of other things going off in Hood's life at the time, which one of which is that he is sleeping with Jay's ex-girlfriend who he's in love with. It's actually a really beautiful there's so much drama amongst this family, but it's actually I thought it was a really enjoyable thread. So at first, okay, I was like, oh Hood, why have you done this? But he's actually so in love with her.
Aww.
And he sees her for a lot more than what Jay did. And she loves him. The downside is obviously she dated his brother. So, you know, he's like, I love you, but you dated my brother. But then he's also like, I don't care because I've never felt like this about somebody.
Aww.
And they have these really beautiful moments where she's also really vulnerable with him because he's a photographer. The reason they know each other is because Hood takes all of Jay's photographs when he's surfing, basically. And it's why, you know, he's such a big name, as well as it's like sort of propelled Hood's career.
Sure.
But he takes photos of her too. And I think there's a line where she says she's never felt more beautiful than behind his lens. And so she gets really vulnerable and lets him take photos of her while she performs a sexual act and is naked on him. And she's like, they're just for you, develop them privately. And it's in that sort of sense, it's a beautiful moment because you're like, okay, this isn't just, he's not just fucking around. He's actually in love with this girl and she's actually just as equally in love with him.
That's such an act of trust.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Particularly at that time when that presumably would have been enormously scandalous.
Yeah. Like,
I mean, not that it's not now if photos get out, but that could have wrecked her.
Yeah. Like now, if you do that on your phone, even without social media, it's already saved on your phone and that's just for you. But in those days, they had to go and develop those photos. I thought it was a really beautiful moment. It's one of my favorites from the book. Each sibling sort of has a moment. So like Kit is obviously going through a big period of self-discovery. She is trying to find her own footing. She's the youngest. She's the one often looked down upon the most, sort of because they all feel like they have to look after it. But actually, she's the spunkiest. She will say exactly what she's thinking. And there's a scene right at the end, which I won't ruin because it is amazing, where she literally calls this person out. But she also, she feels very inadequate compared to her siblings. Her siblings are like household names. She's actually, in her own right, a really accomplished surfer because they're all sort of based around surfing. They live in Malibu. There's this beautiful moment when they were children where they come across this abandoned surfboard and they all sort of give it a go. And their mum like scrimps and saves. So obviously she's just been left by Mick. So the house is paid off, but she has to earn everything else for the children herself because he's just like completely washed his hands of them. And she scrimps and saves and gets them all surfboards. And they all sort of take a different sort of career based off that. So Nina, while she can surf, she's a good surfer. It's more because she's beautiful that she's modeled. So she surfs. So they call her the surfer girl, but she doesn't do all that much surfing. She actually doesn't do any competitions or anything. She's just, she's the pinup.
Yeah.
Jay is an accomplished like pro surfer. Hood is a photographer, but specifically in that field. And Kit's actually a really accomplished surfer who's sort of in the like behind the scenes sort of thing of her own siblings. They don't mean to. They all look after her. There's a moment where Nina actually admits to herself, it's one of her chapters, that she sort of has babied her and she thinks it's sort of affected Kit finding herself. And she feels very guilty about that. So they're all very aware that, you know, they've made their own family dynamic in the wake of all the things that they've been through. But Kit goes through this feeling of she doesn't feel very sexy. She doesn't feel very, you know, part of the party vibe because the way she dresses isn't how everyone else dresses and how, you know, she's just not entirely sure of who she wants to be because her sister's like drop dead gorgeous and literally can wear anything and she's practically a supermodel. And then obviously she's got two brothers. She hasn't really got anybody around her that, you know, will go, okay, let's do this. But Nina actually ends up cutting her outfit up for her and ends up making Kit feel like $1 billion, which was just the best thing. And Kit also, I wish it had been explored more, but the book wasn't entirely focused on more than one sibling at a time, if that makes sense. Like, sort of picks them up, drops them, and sort of lets you fill in the gaps yourself. And I also think because in The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, Taylor did such a good job of exploring an LGBTQ plus relationship that there was a nod to it in this one with Kit. I won't say any more than that because it's not actually a lot. It's probably about a paragraph or two. And then it, you know, it's, but it's right near the end and this is a period of 24 hours. She's not going to discover everything about herself in 24 hours.
Sure.
So, you know, it's forgivable. I've heard people comment that, you know, I feel like it was just there as a token. And I don't think it was. I think in the 80s, it's a very different time period. And if you have read The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, you'll know that Taylor does such a great job of exploring that dynamic of what it's like to live in those times, especially if you're gay. It's nodded to, but I think people forget that the book, the party itself is told over 24 hours. So I would have actually felt more hard done by if she'd realized everything about herself all in one party. I feel like
like it was shoehorned in to make a point. See, I've got representation rather than just being an honest development of the character.
Yeah, so that's Kit. Kit sort of like thread through, but as the youngest, her biggest thing is more she wants to step out of, you know, the shadow of her siblings and even her dad, because he's just still looming over them. I mean, he's still massive. He might not be as big as he used to be, but he's still, you know, widely known. He's a massive celebrity of that time. Jay has some health issues going off, not major health issues, but he's dealing with them. And again, this is told over 24 hours. We get flashbacks of him being told the news and him sharing it with this girl that he really likes. More so because he doesn't feel like he can tell anybody else. He doesn't want to worry anybody. He's not really dealt with it himself yet. And he's wrestling with that because it's going to affect his entire career now because it's life changing. And he's having to make these big decisions. And normally he can tell his family, but he doesn't want to worry them. So he hasn't really got anybody else. And he falls really hard for this girl because she just seems like everything. They have this one night of mind-blowing amazingness. And he's like, that's it. I've never felt like this about another girl before. And he sort of, you know, tries to impress her. He goes to her workplace to, you know, just buy a sandwich just to see her. And he invites her to the party. And he sort of confesses how he feels. And she's like, yeah, not about that life, my good friend. And he's really hurt. So he's dealing with all of that. He also discovers the secret of what Hood has been up to, which isn't nice, but I will leave that there. And then Nina is just, we first meet her and she just seems really empty and really broken. And I was a bit confused because I was like, oh, okay, I thought she'd be like the hard party-going girl. But actually, I misjudged her wrong because as soon as I hit like a quarter of the way of the book in, I realised that she has just people-pleased her entire life. I don't think she knows anything that she wants. She's just done things. And there's this scene where she sort of says that she's given up everything. She's even sold her ass for her family because there's this swimsuit. She was wearing this white swimsuit on a surfboard and she was, you can't see anything, but there's enough that you can see.
Mm.
And, you know, her manager's like, oh, we'll talk about doing Playboy. And she's just like so uncomfortable by this. It's not something that she wants, but she had to do things at a time. Otherwise, she didn't want to lose her family. She didn't want to lose, you know, the siblings that are her rock in the face of everything that they've been through. I mean, they've been abandoned and then their mum died. They haven't got anybody else. Their grandparents are dead. You know, it's literally just these four siblings against the world. And it's just what you get from the blurb is this story of the mansion burning down. But there's so much more. There's so many dynamics. There's all these side characters as well that sort of like breeze in for a page and go off. And some people have commented that they found that quite annoying, but I really like that because it gave this three dimension to this party. Because while this horrible thing is occurring to like one family member, this realization or this, you know, painful experience that they're reliving, on the other side of the party, this guy just rocks up and just puts a cocaine brick on a tray. It gives this dynamic to what is going off, and it makes it more realistic because if you were just following the siblings, you wouldn't know why the house burns down. It would be quite hard, I think, to understand. Also, it's just interesting. Some of these characters, like some of them, I think there was a girl. She literally comes to the party. She's going to quit her job the next day and she's going to go back home and marry like a good man. But she's like, tonight at this party, I'm going to get, I want to have sex with two men in a pool. And it's like, she's just like throwing all caution to the wind at this one party. And you're just like, okay. This is wild. But I think it's done so that you are taken a little bit out of the story and then, you know, thrown back in to deal with something emotional. I think that's the purpose of it. And I really liked it. I liked that at times it felt a bit disjointed because you're like, oh God, how must they be feeling? And then the next thing it's like you're in Wendy's head and Wendy's going to quit her job and she's going to go back home and marry a good man. But tonight she's going to have sex with these two men in a pool. And you're like, well, you know, all for you, Wendy. That's great.
You go, Wendy.
You go, Wendy. But then in the next chapter, we're back with a different family member who's experiencing something completely different. It sort of breaks up all that emotionalness, but without losing the tension, because obviously this is all happening at once. So I just really, really liked that. Obviously, if you couldn't already guess, I'm a massive fan of Taylor Jenkins Reid anyway. I think her work is just beautifully haunting and at times so deeply emotional. It just gets under your skin. I felt so drained when I finished the book, but in a good way, in a way that I did with Seven Husbands. And I just sat there for a while and I was like, I think this has changed my life a little bit. Aww. Like, I feel like you understand the human experience a little bit more every time you read one of her books because she delves into, I wouldn't say an ugly side, but a more human side that we don't often get in a book. We literally see Nina put her makeup on and we see the person underneath that makeup as well. And we see them underneath all of that and all the experiences she's had as well. Just quickly to touch on Mick, the father, the unfaithful man, the famous rock star. He has probably got a lot of other children. I'm just going to throw that out there.
If you're the kind of guy who's out a lot and like just being careless, that seems like the kind of thing that you've probably got more out there.
Yeah.
She's just the only one that bothered to show up at your wife's house.
Yeah, that, I mean the balls, but...
Kind of respect to the other woman for having that level of... Also, I mean, major dick move.
Yeah.
Take responsibility for your own damn baby.
I think there's a lot...
But also, like... Wow.
She says the line, a boy should be with his father. She was crying. I wouldn't say she was like stoic or dead inside as she was handing this baby over to June. But I also wondered when I was reading this, this is the 50s or maybe it's the 60s at this point, because obviously they're a little bit older, that I was thinking to myself, I wonder if she's suffering from postpartum.
Yeah.
And she's just lost it because she's on her own and she doesn't know what to do. And obviously that thread isn't picked up. This is just an assumption made by me. But when I read it, I thought that's a hard decision to make. Like no one just thinks of giving a baby. Like she's carried it full term.
Yeah.
He's still a newborn, but he's obviously been around for a couple of weeks. He's not like fresh from the womb.
Sure.
And she's made that decision. So she's been with that baby and she still made that decision. That can't have been an easy decision. Ballsy AF, but I don't think it could have been easy.
No, for sure.
There's a lot more that I could continue to say, and I don't want to in a way because I don't want to ruin the book. I know I've mentioned some pretty big plot threads, and I've sort of wrapped up sort of even Kit by accident, but just more so that anyone who went into this, I don't want you to think it's got a strong LGBTQ representation in it. There's a lot of things I want to say about Nina because she was just such a character. I started off like, oh, she's going to be dead spoiled. I wasn't. I was like, okay, why is she so sad? It also gives that layer to, you know, when we look at someone who's famous and they look sad in a photo and you're like, how can they be sad? They've got all this money, but she has so much going off.
Sure.
And she would just, as the book went on, I just wanted to throw more and more hands for her because she made choices and she did the right thing and she stepped up. But that's the thing, she stepped up when she shouldn't have. Someone else should have been stepping up for her. She was 16. The prose for me and the writing is one I thoroughly enjoy. I think if you've read one of Taylor's books before and it hasn't agreed with you, I wouldn't pick it up. Her prose is what makes her books the way that they are. And if you've struggled with that in the past, I don't think any of her later books are going to change that. Because if anything, I feel like her writing's sharper. It's more direct sometimes. And rather than before, it was like, did she just punch me with that? And now it's like, oh yeah, she full on walloped me with that emotional line just there. I am a massive fan of the way that Taylor Jenkins Reid sort of holds you at arm's length when she writes, and she gives you the space to be able to build those emotions in yourself. So if you can find yourself relating to a character, it deepens the story and it deepens that connection and it makes you want to, you know, protect them. It also makes them seem more human and more realistic. And at times it's very hard when you read one of her books to not believe that the characters are real. Like, you're not reading an autobiography, you're reading a story, because the way she shows all the layers, all the sharp edges, as well as all the curves of each character, is something that I don't often see in work, which is why for me she's sort of an autobiography author, because I'm in awe of her work. I'm just in awe of the way she tells a story. I do wish that we got more of the boys, especially when Jay reveals his health concern. Him dealing with that outside of him telling the girl that he likes, outside of the family, what his relationship is going to be like with himself and his career, I think would have been interesting to develop further. I don't feel like it's missing. I feel like you could put the book down and you wouldn't really think anything of it. But it was something that at the time I was like, this would be interesting. It'd be nice to see how he's going to deal with this. And then I didn't get that. I also wished we could see the book sort of ends as soon as the party sort of wraps up. We don't get like a prologue. We don't get, you know, 24 hours later or anything. It is literally hits this certain time, the book ends. And I love that. And I liked that. I'm still a bit salty about that because I just want to know that they're all okay. But I also, you know, sometimes you don't get to know that information. Sometimes you don't. I'm more annoyed because I'm greedy than I'm annoyed because it wasn't wrapped up well.
Yeah.
I liked that, you know, she cut me off. She gave me my fill and then cut me off. I sometimes feel like I talk about Taylor Jenkins Reid like she's an addiction, because when I read her work, I'm like, okay, but now I need more. Give me more. But yeah, I'm sort of at my wrap up, if there's anything you would like to ask me.
No, I don't think there's anything that I wanted to ask that hadn't been kind of
covered.
Yeah.
By my excellent notes this week.
Exactly.
So Malibu Rising is very scandalous, but it has so much heart. A lot like a lot of Taylor's other works. I like that we got so many snippets of side characters and background characters, as well as a deep dive into each of the siblings, especially Nina. Nina is the glue that holds everyone together. So I thought it was good that we also got an insight into each of the other siblings worrying about Nina in their own way, because they've all seen a slightly different side of her. I think I mentioned this earlier, but the party itself was like literally reading Project X meets the 80s, and it was the best thing ever. And if it ever gets made into a TV show or a movie, I think it's going to be one that is going to be full of awe. I've heard some people comment that it feels a bit Great Gatsby because Nina goes off for some of the party and just, you know, has a moment to herself. I didn't get that vibe where, you know, Gatsby throws this huge party and then just like F's off and just leaves everyone to deal with it. I didn't get that vibe. There's a lot of other things going off, and there's a lot of different things that she's having to deal with. And if anything, I don't think she really wanted the party. She's throwing it for other people. That's just my opinion though, but I just really connected with her. Your enjoyment of the story will depend on if you're familiar a little bit with divorce or loss, because the drama that's tackled throughout it is amazing and it's still worth reading. But I think it's what happened in the 50s that'll make you love the story. And if anything, I would actually love my own spin-off of Mick and June and just reading all about from the moment they met to, you know, what Mick thought of when Jean passed away, because that would have been really interesting. But, you know, I'll forgive you, Taylor. I'll forgive you. There are a lot of little nods to some of her other work, and I'm starting to wonder if there's a little Jenkins Reid universe going off. Hopefully, more books she publishes. I'll be able to answer that question later on. The ending for me was brilliant. I had sort of thought maybe a certain thing will happen, but when it did happen, it was executed a lot better than I thought it was going to be. There were some really powerful moments. There was a lot of sacrifice and there was a lot of inner turmoil. And I think we were left with some of that, which I think is why I found it so draining in a good way. You're not left with all the answers at the end. You're left in a comfortable place where you can move on. And sometimes that is the only thing I struggle with Taylor's books, is that I feel like she cuts me off just as I want more. Probably wise, like I said. Maybe she's a bit of an addiction for me, but yeah. And so when it came to my seashell rating, I wrote 4.5, but I don't know why I wrote that, because I don't think I have a bad thing to say about the book. I think it was just...
Be honest, come on.
It was just 5 seashells for me.
Yeah.
I loved it. It actually weirded me out more than I was going back for our old episodes. And I've rated her work all the time. Why I've only ever read one of her other books on the podcast, because I keep reading them outside of it. But yeah, for me, it was an easy 5 seashells. At first, when I started the book, admittedly, hopefully I'll be a bit better by the time this comes out, but I've not been in a great place recently. I'm not going to like go into it too much. But when I first started it, I was like, oh my God, am I going to be able to deal with this? It seems like there's a lot of heartache and a lot of pain in this book. And as the book took me through everything, I cried. And I don't know if I cried because, you know, I normally would cry at a book, or if I'm crying because I'm just as broken. But it just hit me in all the right places and all in the wrong places all at the same time. But I think I cried at a lot of her other books as well. So I think I just naturally cry and I go through the motions with her. But yeah, it was just 5 seashells. She was just amazing. And I'm just so thankful for Taylor Jenkins Reid.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, so... will Malibu Rising come with you to the Island Library?
It will.
Woo!
Woo! I know. It felt rude not to, kind to be of. Fair. But I do have a confession. So, Jo made a bit of a boo-boo a couple of episodes ago, and she threw the same book in the ocean twice. Now, this is just tardiness on my part, and I will fully own up to it, because I didn't update my little spreadsheet. So, before I say what book Malibu Rising is replacing, I am also throwing a very large, expansive sea into the water, because I had to throw another book in from a previous episode. But I threw it in the ocean, mainly because I'm excited to read some of that author's newer works as well. And then, you know, I had to pick another contemporary book. But anyway, Malibu Rising is replacing In 5 Years. The gasp from Laura is because In 5 Years was, I believe, the first book I said yes to.
It was.
And it has been the book that I measure so many other books to.
It has been.
It is still such a special book, but I thought it was time, because the impact In 5 Years left on me at the time is the same impact I walked away from when I finished Malibu Rising.
Oh, wow.
And it felt only fair that In 5 Years has had a great time. It's, you know, got a lovely suntan, it's had a lot of coconuts, and it was time to float it away. I still love it, and it was very painful, but when I was looking at my list, I was like, if I'm taking this, it has to replace that. There is no other book it can replace.
Wow. The...
So yeah, bye-bye In 5 Years. You will be sorely missed. But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just I thought that explained it better, what he was replacing, because then everyone will know how much.
Yeah,
I don't think sometimes you can say it in a seashell rating. But yeah, that was Malibu Rising. It was
okay. So I have a random question.
Oh, thank God, because I'm dying.
It's time for Laura's random question of the week. Do-do-do.
Yay! Love that.
So I want to know, Jo, what is your favourite book cover on your shelf? Possibly an odd choice for an audio medium, but we're running with it.
So, the limited edition version of Crooked Kingdom.
Ooh, what does that look like?
I tell a lie. It's the collector's edition.
Oh.
Soz. For context, Leigh Bardugo released a collector's edition for both Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom. And I think she's now doing it for Shadow and Bone as well. Six of Crows is red. Okay. And I did like it, but some of her other books are gold.
Right.
But this is...
Okay, black with like gold foil.
But then...
Ooh, black sprayed edges. We like, yeah.
It's like one of my favourite books as well. So then when it came out and it was gold as well, I was like, yes! Yes! What about yourself?
You would think that I'd have an answer prepared for this, wouldn't you? Given that I asked the question.
Can I just say as well, what was really close was the Gilded Ones, which we read last week.
You know, I thought about going for the Gilded Ones. That's another one with like gold foil accents on the cover, which I just think looks absolutely stunning.
So
I think
stunning.
It's starker on Crooked Kingdom against the black.
Yeah.
But against the green on Gilded Ones looks lovely.
While you look, I'll explain also why this cover is so cool. All over the book, there's little nods to the crows. So we've got the cards from Jesper, we've got the knives, we've got gloves, we've got crows, we've got all of it, all over it. And it's just, I think that's what makes it really stand out.
Okay, I think I'm going to go with Strange the Dreamer, the hardcover edition. So again, we've got gold foil. It's kind of a deep blue though. So I think that's a really nice combo. And we've got blue sprayed edges. Sprayed edges just, I don't know how difficult or expensive they actually are, but they always feel really exciting.
Also, I think we've all just learned that Joe and Laura are magpies.
Yeah.
We're just really attached to gold.
We like our shiny books.
We like shiny, shiny books.
Yeah, there's this really delicate moth kind of diagram thing on the front, which is all in gold foil and lots of very fine detailing, which is really interesting.
Yeah. No, it's very, very pretty. Very pretty. It's hard as well because like sometimes a cover like just absolutely grabs you and you're like, oh my God, the cover is so gorgeous.
Mm.
And then it's like, well, is that my favourite though? Because like such and such.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so many covers. So many covers. Malibu Rising's cover is actually really beautiful. But please let us know what your favourite book cover is, because it might be a book we've not even read.
Yeah.
Which then means that we can read it. And you can let us know what your favourite book is, either on Instagram at the Island Library Podcast.
You can find us on Twitter at the Island Lib Pod.
Or you can email us at theislandlibrary@gmail.com or go to our wonderful website, www.theislandlibrary.com, where you can also find out more information about our amazing book club.
Find out what we're reading at the moment, where you can read along. You can let us know what you think on Instagram, Twitter, via email, all of the usual methods. If you want, you can also join the book club, which is a really lovely bunch of people. We meet once a month, we chat about the books, and we have a whale of a time.
Also, if you think we're amazing and you want to help support the podcast and help us, you know, give more back, you can find us on Patreon, where we do very different tiers of subscriptions.
Thank you so much to all of our existing Patreon subscribers. We really appreciate you. Thank you to all of our book club members who help us keep this thing running and have so much fun with us. And thank you to every single one of you who downloads and listens. We do this for all of you guys.
Thank you as well to you, Laura, for letting me into your home.
Thanks, Jo, for recording with me again. Always a pleasure.
See you next time.
See you next time.
Bye. Bye.
I'm really hungry. I haven't had breakfast yet.
I haven't had breakfast either, if that makes you feel any better.
It just makes me sad for you too.
Why?
Because now we're both hungry.
Aww.